Anochi nosein lifnechem hayom biracha uklala. See, I present before you today a blessing and a curse. OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Re'eh and the first day of Rosh Chodesh Elul. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 28th day of Menachem Av, 5775, corresponding this year to August 13. So that's where we're holding. Last Shabbat we announced Rosh Chodesh Elul will be next Shabbat, Ulamachrato, and the following day, Yom Rishon, Av, Menachem Av, has 30 days. Therefore, its 30th day becomes the first day of Rosh Chodesh Elul, and Elul actually begins Motzoi Shabbat, Saturday night, Sunday, with the first day of Elul, which is the second day of Rosh Chodesh Elul. Confusing? Get used to it. That's the story. So, we will talk about Re'eh, and we will talk about Elul. More about Re'eh, because there's an awful lot to discuss. And let's start with Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shima V'Koli Tihyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imcha hasalicha lema'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mi kol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umeafela l'ora, umishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Hard to choose what in Re'eh to speak about. Re'eh has 55 mitzvot out of the 613. It is number 3 on the all-time mitzvah list. Ki Teitse, 2 weeks' time from now, has 74. Emor, back in Vayikra, had 63. And Re'eh has 55. Just to complete the top 6, we go to Mishpatim with 53. And then Kedoshim with 51, Shofetim next week with 41. And that is, I believe, a set of mitzvot which cover an awful lot. You have to add up the numbers yourself. I don't have it in my head at the moment. And the lion's share of mitzvot in those 6 sedras. I stopped at 41 for Shofetim because the next one after that is 28, which is quite a distance down from 41, and even that 28 is a significant number of mitzvot. Mitzvot, as I've said many times, are not evenly distributed throughout the Torah. There are 17 different sedras that have no mitzvot at all out of the 613. They obviously teach us other things, but not mitzvot per se. And then there are the big mitzvah sedras, specifically focusing on the book of Devarim, as I have mentioned. The first three sedras are behind us now. That would be Devarim, Avot Hanan, and Akev. In those three sedras, you have relatively few mitzvot. You have the beginning, the first section of Moshe Rabbeinu's talk to the people, where the emphasis is not on specific mitzvot as much as it is on who we are. We are the Jewish people. We came out of Egypt. Various things happened to us in the course of the last 40 years. He's speaking to the new generation. He's speaking to all of us in perpetuity. And there's a lot of background with Chet HaEgel and Chet HaMeraglim and other things. The fundamentals of Judaism, Shema Yisrael V'Yahavta, the first passage, the Hoya'im Shemoah, the second passage, the Aseret HaDibrot in the description of Ma'amad Har Sinai. And one gets the sense that when Moshe Rabbeinu was finishing up whatever he was telling us in Akev, he said to the people, when you come tomorrow for my lecture, make sure you bring lots of paper and pencils or papyrus and whatever they scratched on it, and because there's going to be a lot of details now. So it's if to say, we just gave you the introduction, the fundamentals, and the brief history of the Jewish people and Judaism. Now it's Tachlis time, and in the Sedras of Re'eh this week, Shofatim next week, Ki Teitzei the week after, you have a total of 170 mitzvot. I did an additional calculation this week, and I found that this set of three Sedras, beginning with Re'eh from this Shabbat, has a mitzvah density of 551 mitzvot per 1,000 psukim. Pardon the almost flippant use of that terminology, but it gives you a way of comparing. I took a look also at Acharei, Kedoshim, Emor, and Behar, four sedras in Vayikra, which also have a heavy concentration of mitzvot. Not 170, but 166, and enough fewer psukim so that the mitzvah density of those four sedras in Vayikra was also 551 mitzvot per 1,000 psukim. And that doesn't mean anything very significant, but I find it interesting. And I guess there's a difference between significant and interesting. In any event, Re'eh has a whole bunch of topics, 55 mitzvot and other things that are presented. And I'm not going to start from the beginning, but I'm going to start from where the lead tidbit this week also took off on, and it's based on a visit that I made last Sunday, this past Sunday, to the relatively new biblical Natural History Museum in Beit Shemesh. I highly recommend it for anyone interested in nature, animals, and Torah. And I found it interesting, and I will share certain things that were presented, but that's the topic that I'm going to start with. All the animals that we eat must chew their cud and have split feet, if you remember that song. I recently was told that Rabbi Shraga Silverstein, Zichrono Livracha, made up that song way, way back, and people of a certain age range know it well. I don't know if they're still singing it, but it was the Jewish version of Old MacDonald, which maybe I'll play at the beginning of the second half of the show. Okay, let me take you through it and see how far we get. When we say kosher animals, we have to take a step back and look at the full topic of forbidden, permitted, and forbidden food. Ma'achalot asurot, or ma'achalim asurim, or some combination thereof, somebody I am sure will email me the correct terminology, means forbidden foods, and it comes in different categories. When we're talking about animals, We're talking about four categories of animals: mammals, birds, fish, and insects, of which there are kosher and non-kosher types. In addition to that, meaning what animal you may eat and what animal may you not eat, we also have the rules of shechita, ritual slaughter, in order to permit us to eat from the meat of one of the kosher animals. And that is a topic in Parshat Re'eh as well. We have the prohibition of nevela, eating meat of a kosher animal that died other than by shechita, a closely related but significantly different prohibition called trefa. And then there's the issue of the blood inside the animal and all kind of other things. Milk and meat gets into here, and the topic of forbidden foods is a big one when it comes to produce that grows in the ground, especially from Eretz Yisrael. We have a whole bunch of other forbidden foods, but we're not getting into that now. I just want to make a comment that the term kosher is a generic term for anything we're allowed to consume, and non-kosher, of course, what we're not allowed to consume. But the technical term, the halachic term, for the animals that are kosher is tahor. Tahor, as opposed to tameh. So you have a behema tahora, which we would translate as a kosher domesticated mammal, like cow, like goat, like sheep. We have behema tameah, non-kosher animal, domesticated, like horse, like pig, like camel. We have Chaya tohora. A chaya is a non-domesticated animal, a wild animal, and to that category of the tohora, the kosher ones, belong a variety of antelopes and deer, which and wild goats and other animals as well that are classified that way. Behema and chaya together are the mammals. If they are tahora, then we're allowed to eat them. If they are tameah, we're not allowed to eat them. Okay. Then in the birds, same thing. Of tahor, of tameh, a kosher bird and a non-kosher bird. Dag tahor, dag tameh, a kosher fish, a non-kosher fish. And in the insects, let's take care of that first, because most people say ew, ew, ew. But we'll say it like this. The Torah lists four types or four families of locusts slash grasshoppers, which are kosher, and all the rest of insect world are not kosher. And only Yemenites, some Yemenites and some Moroccans, have an unbroken tradition as to how to identify the kosher locust. And in that situation, their communities would be able to eat them. In fact, I saw a recipe for sun-dried locust in a kosher Yemenite cookbook once. And not going to get too far into that, because the majority of the Jews belong to the communities that have lost the ability to identify which insects are kosher, which locust grasshoppers are kosher, and which are not. And that's the story. So we could move the insects to the back burner or put them on the shelf, because we're not going to discuss them more. But I want to take a closer look at mammals, birds, and fish. Maybe we'll start with fish first, even though the Torah treats them second. The Torah says that any fish that has fins and scales in the water, or fins and scales, period, is tahor, and we may eat them. And those fishes and other sea creatures that do not have fins and scales, we may not eat. So you have a large number of species of fish that are kosher. I need to say a few things here, although this can't really turn into be a very intensive study of any of the things. I just want to throw out the ideas. I've told my story. I'll briefly review it here because it fits. And that is when we in Yeshiva University, a course called Comparative Vertebrate Anatomy, was sitting in a lab with Professor William Etkin, Zichrono Levracha, and we were about to dissect a shark, a small 1 foot long shark called a dogfish shark. We studied its external features, and we had prepared well, so we all knew the caudal fins, the dorsal fins, the lateral fins, and the dorsal fin on the back. A pectoral is the other pair of fins. 7 fins, 3 pairs, and the dorsal fin. That's the one that's accompanied by sinister music when it swims close to the surface of the water. And then he asked us, what are these? And we saw what he was pointing to, and we said, placoid scales. And he said, scales? A shark has scales? A shark has fins? So it's kosher. We said, no, a shark is not kosher. He said, look, what do you see? Scales and fins. Fins and scales. So why isn't a shark kosher? So we tried to say, because a shark eats other fish and could eat people. Not a criterion for whether a fish is tahor or tameh, kosher or not kosher. So he left us pondering why a shark is not kosher if it has scales and fins. Now his point was, we shouldn't have been pondering the answer to that question. We should have pondered the question. In other words, he accused us, or he challenged us to say, last night when you were studying the dissection manual, did any of you, after seeing the words shark, scales, fins, over and over again, did any of you think there was a question to ask vis-a-vis its status as kosher or not kosher? The answer is, but the point was well taken, but I'll go to the answer because that's what I'm talking about now. The answer is that placoid scales are part of the skin of the shark. They are of dermal origin. They do not scrape off easily. And that means they don't belong to that category of scales that constitutes a kosher fish. Simply put, sharks do not have, they have fins, but they do not have halachic scales, even though what they have we call scales, it's a different kind of scale. The scale that makes a fish kosher is one that can be scraped off easily with a knife or with your fingernail even, without doing damage to the underlying skin. Kosher fish, like tuna and salmon and carp and halibut and flounder and a whole variety of other fish, have those kind of scales. They have fins and they're kosher. Seafood is not, because they don't have scales and fins by that definition. And there are many types of fish that are not. There are a few kinds of fish that people for generations were considering as not kosher. And then somebody did a re-examination and realized that they do have scales that scrape off. They don't look exactly like the standard kind of scales. I once thought that they needed to be overlapping scales like a sheet of armor, and I was told, no, that's not one of the guidelines. A fish is kosher if it has scales, period. They don't have to overlap. So the most recent, at least in my knowledge, of a fish that was declared to be kosher because it has true halachic scales and fins was the blue marlin. And it's a big, big game fish, and that was a big thing. It looks very much like a swordfish. The swordfish controversy goes back many, 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 many years. And it is still not accepted in many of the kashrut circles as being kosher, although the arguments continue. And sturgeon was a traditional fish that didn't have proper scales, and that was considered non-kosher. And the big deal about sturgeon is that was the common fish, the eggs of which were caviar, and therefore that was a big thing also. And that thing is maybe a little bit still up in the air, but it's generally considered not kosher. You could go onto the internet and you can find many, many lists from kashrut organizations of kosher and non-kosher fish. And enough said about that, because I'm anxious to get to the mammals and the birds. The Torah gives us signs for the kashrut of a mammal. Everyone, most people know this, and that is it has to have a split hoof and it has to chew its cud. Animals that chew their cud are called ruminants. They have a multi-chambered stomach, which allows for a first initial chewing of food, goes down the esophagus to one chamber of the stomach, where it's mixed with various stomach juices, and then regurgitated into the mouth, reversing up the esophagus into the mouth of the animal, who then chews this wad of partially digested food known as a cud, and then re-swallows it, where it undergoes further digestion in a different chamber of the stomach. And that's about all I know, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. And those animals are called ruminants, and they chew their cud. That's an internal sign. The external sign is split hoof. And there are many varieties of the types of hooves that animal have. It has to be completely split. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Re'eh. As I indicated earlier, there was old MacDonald had a farm, and most of those animals that he mentions are kosher, with the exception of the pig, and if he mentions the dog also, whatever. Not the point. We're still talking about animals. We were in the middle of talking about the mammals with their signs of kashrut. A lot of different directions that I could go in here. And I want to sort of stay on a certain track. The question is, if a mammal that we've never seen before, which are fewer and fewer, has split hooves and turns out to be a cud chewer, does that make it kosher? Do we need, which we will be talking about when we get to birds, a masoret, a tradition? Do we eat cow meat because generations after generations of Jews throughout our history have eaten the meat of cow, and we have a tradition that a cow is an acceptable animal? Or do we just recognize the cow as having split hoof and chewing its cud, and therefore it's kosher? The question with a cow, a regular normal cow, is moot. Doesn't make a difference. But there are many, many other kind of animals where it does make a big difference. I started to say before that in Parshat Shmini the signs of kashrut are given, split hoof and chewing the cud, and the non-kosher animals that have one or the other of those signs, gamal, shafan, arnevet, that are cud chewers and don't have split hoof, and the chazir, the pig, that has a split hoof but doesn't chew its cud, those are the animals we're not allowed to eat. All other animals have neither sign of kashrut, and therefore certainly we're not allowed to eat them. No non-kosher, only non-kosher animals are named in Shemini. In Parshat Re'eh, we find a difference. In Parshat Re'eh, the Torah tells us, Zot ha-behema asher tochelu. These are the behemot that we may eat, shor, sei chvasim v'sei izim. A cow. A shor is usually translated ox, but that's a problem here. We're going to have to call it cow, meaning the more general bovine term. And the sheep and the goat. Then the Torah continues to name seven more animals, all of which are probably not behemot, but chayot, as tohorot. Ayal, utzvi, v'yachmur, v'ako, v'dishon, uto, v'zamer. And all animals that have split hoof and chew their cud, those we're allowed to eat. So it gave a general rule, the signs of kashrut of a kosher animal, and mammal, and gave us names of 10 animals. Cow, goat, and sheep, as I mentioned before, have been in our experience, Jewish experience, throughout the generations. And here we're talking about a specific problem to Hebrew. Hebrew was not spoken for centuries. It was still the language of the Torah and Tanakh. It still was the Jewish learning language, but it wasn't commonly spoken. And therefore, when it was revived in recent times, there were words that were needed, and there were words that existed, and those that were composing the first modern Hebrew dictionary often matched a name with an animal, which is not necessarily the same as that name was used in ancient times. So I'm looking at the Art Scroll Stone Edition Chumash. It translates Ayal as a hart, H-A-R-T, and a tzvi as a deer. But the next ones, five more, are translated, not translated, they are written as is. Hebrew, the yachmur, English, and the yachmur, the ako, the dishon, the to'o, and the zamer. What's a zamer? A zamer is a zamer. Our scroll doesn't want to tell us what a zamer is because there is controversy, because it was an unknown animal for a long time, and there are differences of opinion. You look in their footnotes, and it says, for example, the zemer. Here they write zamer, but that's a grammatical thing. It's a zemer. Is a giraffe, according to Rav Sadia and Radak. But the Gemara seems to understand it as a wild goat. So here's an example, and the example continues in every other mammal that's mentioned here, and certainly in all of the birds, or almost all of the birds, where Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, in his Chumash, and the Art Scroll, which might follow that lead, are resistant to giving an English translation to names of birds, especially, because we don't know. Kanfei Nesharim, the wings of eagles. Nesher, eagle. A Nesher is not an eagle. Research has discovered, has uncovered, that a Nesher which is a non-kosher bird, listed as a non-kosher bird, first of the list of 21 types of birds, is more likely to be the griffin vulture, which is a large vulture that lives in parts of Israel and fits more of the definition as given by the Gemara. So it just keeps going on for that. This is a gull. No, some say it's a type of owl. This one is an owl. It's a barn owl, a screech owl. And here you get into the other problem that the words, even in English, but certainly in Hebrew, can cover dozens of species, which may or may not be accurate. In other words, there could be, when you speak of home on the range where the deer and the antelope play, deer and antelope can cover dozens of species, vastly different types of animals from each. Again, if it has a split hoof and it chews its cud, it's a kosher animal. But the question is, which name does it fit? What's a Dishon? What's an Akko? What's a To'o? Don't know. When, you know, there are people who say, give me beef or lamb chops or goat meat and leave me alone. Don't give me these exotic things. What about the bison, the American buffalo? What about the European buffalo known as the water buffalo? What about a gnu? What's new with you? Also known as a wildebeest. What about a yak? These are classified together, some of them, let's take the yak for example, is classified together with the cow. But the question is a yak really the shore that the Torah said this is an animal you could eat? So again, you examine, you check, and you ask, does a yak chew its cud and have split hooves? If the answer is yes, then most authorities will say it's kosher. But there are those that say, no, we are not totally sure what the Torah means when it says cud chewer, male gera. It could have a shade of meaning which can mislead us into declaring an animal kosher or not kosher based on our finite understanding and possibly wrong understanding. So there is a very small minority of authorities who say you need a masoret, a tradition. And if you don't have shochatim who say, my father was a shochet, my grandfather was a shochet, and he used to slaughter American bison, or he used to slaughter giraffes, then we don't have a tradition that a bison or a giraffe is a kosher animal. Again, I say the overwhelming majority of authorities say that for mammals, you do not need a masoret. You need physical evidence of split hoof and chewing the cud. I shouldn't really talk because I've eaten cow meat and I'm pretty sure I've had lamb. I don't think I've ever had goat meat, and it's a very, very popular meat in this part of the world. And I haven't tasted venison, although I understand that there's a booming business in glatt kosher deer meat in the States. And certainly the more exotic mammals I haven't tried. But there is a notion, and some people take this very seriously, especially guys like Ari, that if you're allowed to eat something, you should expand your horizons. Now, even if we are satisfied with the meat that's available to us, Ari, I'm talking about Ari Greenspan, Ari Zivotofsky, have both together been in Africa, where there is a small Jewish community in a certain country, where the locally available source of meat would be a kudu or an eland or an oryx or whatever, and they need to know if it's kosher. And these guys, Ari and Ari, have actually gone down and shechted large antelopes for the Jewish community there to be able to have meat, where the kind of meat that we have access to might not be available to them. Let me move on to birds. Because birds, the Torah does not give us signs, simanim. The Torah gives us a list of birds that are not kosher. And the basic conclusion from that is that all other birds are kosher. And yet we have a strong ruling, which is stuck to, as far as I know, that you need a masoret. I said the Torah does not give signs of kashrut, but the Gemara does. And it says, for example, that a bird that is a predator, a dores, one that will attack another animal and kill it, is definitely a not kosher bird. Even if you can't tell which one of the 21 families it belongs to, it's a sign that the bird is not kosher. What if a bird is not a dores, is not a predatory bird? It eats seeds, and it eats fruit, and that's all. Is that a kosher bird? We have no reason to question whether it's a kosher bird, but that apparently is not enough, because we cannot determine to absolute certainty that a bird is actually fits into the signs that the Gemara gives and that are not located on this list from Parshat Re'eh or Parshat Shmini. In lieu of certainty, one goes by tradition. So chickens are unquestionably kosher because your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your great-great-grandparents ate chicken. But even in chicken, there are types of chickens that were not part of the usual diets of Jewish communities, certainly Ashkenazi Jewish communities, wherever they be, and we're not 100% sure about them either. So there has been a search ongoing for many, many years to determine whether you can establish a masoret, a tradition, an unbroken tradition, for the acceptability of certain birds. Now, again, Ari and Ari have interviewed countless shochatim from all kind of communities, and when they show pictures of certain birds and an old Moroccan shochet lights up and he says, I haven't done one of those, but my father used to do them, or my father told me that his father used to shech those kind of birds, and he used to do it for the wealthier people in the community because it was rare or whatever, that can establish a tradition which will allow certain types of pheasant and other birds to be accepted as kosher. Again, when it comes to birds, I've had duck, I've had goose, maybe, certainly chicken. I was going to say I had turkey, which I have, but even turkey was subject to controversy because some claimed no matter how similar it is to being a chicken, it's a different kind of bird, and there was no masoret that it's acceptable. And others, authorities and sources, pushed for statements that have been made in the past about turkey to either constitute a masoret or at least be acceptable as a testimony for the kashrut of those birds. I could go on and on about this stuff, but let me switch to another topic until the time runs out. Just let me say the bottom line. There are kashrut organizations, the OU, the Star K, the OK, the Cuff K, and others around the world who are doing the work for us, which is a good thing because the research is beyond the ability of the average person and shouldn't be the domain of the average person. We have responsible organizations who keep updating their list, and you can always ask. I saw a question, which I'm not going to get into the answer now, was I was visiting Tibet, and I want to know if I could drink yak milk. So that's a question. It's not a question that I've had recently to ask, or most people that I know, but somebody had to ask it. And there are responsible, knowledgeable, expert organizations that can handle those kind of questions. So this has been really an academic thing, taking us behind the scenes, but it's a serious issue, as well as many others in Parshat Re'eh and in the rest of the Torah. One of the topics in Re'eh is Shmitat Ksafim. We don't have time to do that this week, but maybe as we get closer to the end of the year, we'll talk about Prusbul as one of the topics. You have, again, a lot of different mitzvot and topics here. I'm just quickly looking at the list to see what I could finish with. Let me go back to the beginning of the Sedra and finish up with the opening words. Re'eh, see, and look clearly. Anochi noten lifnechem hayom biracha uklala. I am giving you today a choice of blessing or curse. This idea is repeated in a few different places in the Torah. Et habracha, what is the blessing? Asher tishme'u el mitzvot Hashem Elokeichem, asher anochi mitzavetchem hayom. The blessing is that you hearken to the commandments of Hashem, your God, that I command you today. And the curse, if you do not hearken to the commandments of Hashem, your God, and you stray from the path that I command you today, to follow other gods that you did not know. And it continues with the bad stuff, but that's the choice. In other words, blessing is following the Torah and being faithful to God. Curse is not following the Torah and not being faithful to God. This is a choice that we are given. More than that, it is a deal that God has repeated over and over again with us, that if you follow, then good things will happen, and if you don't, bad things will happen. But unlike the few examples, or the many examples we've had of being given this choice, Parshat Re'eh begins that section of the Torah that actually spells out what mitzvot are Moshe Rabbeinu talking about, Moshe Rabbeinu talking about when he says this. Now, it goes for every mitzvah in the Torah. But when you get a, for example, that this is what you have to do and this is what you're not allowed to do, and I think there's something like 17 positive commandments and 38 prohibitions, and the numbers vary in the upcoming Sedras, that it includes a lot of all different kind of things, stuff related to Avodah Zarah, stuff related to what we eat and not eat, as we already went most of the time with, and the Chagim are reviewed here, and the responsibility of charity. We have a series of mitzvot here about being charitable to those less fortunate, and not holding back from them, and even if you have a good logic to say, well, I really don't want to take a chance and lend somebody money even though he needs it, because he probably won't be able to pay me back, or he might not be able to pay me back, the Torah urges us and shows us that giving charity is something which we will be rewarded for, and we should not overthink the risks of loss. I don't know if that's the best way to put it. Maybe it's better to say that, as illogical as this sounds, the more we give, the more we get, not the less we have. There is a pair of mitzvot from this Sedra, which was mentioned also in Vo'et Chanan, and that's the prohibition of adding to or detracting from the Torah. And it has certain, let's say, guidelines for the actual Torah fulfillment or violation thereof. But I want to say in general, that there is a spirit of that law, that one should not add to the Torah by saying something is required when it is only a recommended strict measure to take. And the opposite would be to say that something that is required is only a strict measure recommended. In other words, we need to study Jewish law to the point where we will be able to distinguish and honestly present to ourselves and to our children and their children the true Torah Judaism. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.